Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. There are many Christian churches with many leaders, but only the Roman Catholic Church has an office, with a claim that it enjoys a direct line of succession back to one of the original disciples of Jesus. That office is the office of Pope, and only the papacy has such a powerful hold on the public imagination. I'll give you a personal example. I'm an Episcopalian, and I had to look up who the Archbishop of Canterbury is. He's the worldwide head of the Anglican Communion. He is, by the way, newly appointed Justin Welby to be enthroned in March, and he has hardly the power in the Anglican Communion that the Pope has in the Roman Catholic Church. Well, the process of selecting a new Pope will be getting underway soon in Rome, and to make some sense of it, we've asked two experts on the Catholic Church to join us on Focus. Tom Roberts is editor-at-large for the National Catholic Reporter and author of the book The Emerging Catholic Church, A Community Search for Itself. And Kevin Schultz is assistant professor of history and Catholic studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Kevin, are you with us?
Yeah, good to be with you.
Thank you for being on the show with us. Professor Schultz's publications include Tri-Faith America, How Postwar Catholics and Jews Held America to Its Protestant Promise, and that's now out in a paperback edition from Oxford University Press. As always, we welcome you to the conversation. You can call in with your questions or comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu and send comments via Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. Well, today, it's my understanding that the Pope will become a Pope Emeritus. He will actually, Benedict will actually leave office today. And this is a very rare occurrence. Perhaps I could ask Professor Schultz, when's the last time a Pope stepped down and stuck around?
Well, it's a complicated question. The last time there was something similar to this, where a pope actually resigned to step out of the limelight, was 1294. So, what, 750 years ago? There was a time about 600 years ago when a pope stepped down to sort of clean up a mess that was going on when there were multiple claims to the papacy. But something like this hasn't happened for nearly 800 years.
And I'm wondering, so this... The previous occurrences were special instances, and they were not trendsetters. But there are regulations and rules and policies for a pope's retirement, and maybe also just a different situation now. I mean, medical science can keep people alive for a long time, but not always so good at keeping people in a condition where they are fit to work. So. My question to you, Tom Roberts, is: do you think this will happen more often in the future, that popes will retire instead of dying in office?
You know, I think it's dangerous to make any predictions about papal behavior, but it seems to me that the really fascinating point here is that this traditionalist decided to break with one of, you know, this very long-standing tradition. And I think he, by just doing that, suggests that there are some things that we may have thought immutable that are changeable. And I think, you know, you recognize his language is interesting. I mean, he talks about his health. He also leaves, not with triumphal language, but with language that's in many ways a lament about the condition of the church. So I think there are a lot of things that play into this. And I think what he's saying very plainly is, I'm not up to doing this anymore. And, you know, I think he's given future popes a lot of latitude. We're looking back and saying, okay, it's not working, I'm going to leave, or for reasons, you know, for any number of reasons, who knows what the future will hold. My term is up. It's time for a new guy. So I think he's certainly setting a new precedent. He's certainly giving people, I think, in the future, a lot of room to move, and showing also, in a much larger palette, I think, that traditions can be altered.
I want to ask both of you in a moment about the legacy that Pope Benedict leaves behind, but I want to put that in the context of what the Pope actually does, and no matter what people think about the Pope, what the Pope is actually able to do. I mean, what are the actual executive powers of the Pope? Who can he appoint or hire or order around? Is there entrenched bureaucracy that he deals with? Any other factors that a Pope always has to deal with? And maybe if I could start with you, Professor Schultz.
Yeah, well, the Pope, one of the things that I find interesting about Benedict's decision to abdicate is it suggests a sort of transformation in what the Pope is responsible for. Once upon a time, it was, you know, the Vatican, the Pope was seen as sort of a king of kings in some ways, and then became a spiritual leader. And now it's sort of indicative that he's the head of a giant bureaucracy who goes around making diplomatic visits around the world. And that's exhausting. So I think that is sort of a sign of what's happened to Pope Benedict here. And one of the things that the Pope can do, I mean, certainly bureaucratic control over the Roman Curia and appointing cardinals and bishops and things like that is part of the responsibility. But also, I think most importantly, is setting the tone for the church throughout the world. What causes they're going to get behind, the church is going to get behind and deem to be important. So I think whoever the new pope is, or popes in the future and popes in the past, have always sort of defined their legacy by what it is they want the church to become or to be.
Tom Roberts, could you add on to that?
I think Benedict had a really tough spot to fill in the wake of John Paul II. Of course, had 25 years and loved the spotlight. He loved the big stage, and he loved, you know, the international stuff. And I think it's fairly agreed that inside the church, he kind of let the administration go. And Benedict, I think, in terms of setting a tone, really turned down the spotlight and the microphone a bit. And I know he was known going in as the, you know, sort of the German shepherd, the bulldog and the enforcer and that sort of thing. But I think that the papacy, agree with his, you know, theology or his approach to things or not, was a lot gentler than that in some respects. And so I think his legacy is will eventually be the encyclicals that he wrote, which were really lovely, lovely pieces. And I think that as time goes on, he'll probably be known far more as the theologian he is than as a pope who did anything terribly significant until he retired. That was or abdicated.
I want to ask about the encyclicals. I have heard favorable notices given to his writings as pope before, and I'm thinking this is also a man in his 80s who may or may not be at the height of his powers as a writer. But you're saying that it really was strong writing even among popes.
Well, I think Professor would have a better, you know, maybe a firmer grip on this than I do, because I'm not a theologian. But I think that his books, if you take his trilogy on Jesus, which I haven't read all of, but I've read some of, and his books on becoming a Christian, that sort of thing, he's a world class theology, but it's accessible. And I know that there are people who've become young people who have really engaged the church because of some of his writings. It's an odd dynamic, but that's you know what's happened. I think, you know, the public perceptions, and a lot of them I think are also correct, that might have difficulty with some of his papacy, overshadow those moments. But in the long run, if you're talking about legacy, I don't think anything he did during his papacy is going to jump out as a huge moment. You know, he was not the first one to go to a mosque, not the first one to go to a synagogue. John Paul had all those firsts, and he sort of came in, and I think it was a quieter papacy. But there was some. He's a theologian, and he liked to write, and so I think that his legacy will be in that realm rather than any spectacular events.
Professor Schultz, can you say something more about Pope Benedict's writings?
a little bit, but first thing I'd like to say is that I'm always hesitant to pick to talk about legacies. It's so difficult to predict what will be remembered. I remember when Bill Clinton left office, the only thing anybody could remember was the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and now his efforts at globalization and free trade and things like that seem to be a more important legacy. So it's very difficult to sort of predict these kinds of things. And as with this pope, I think there are sort of two things. One are the writings to which you refer, which are, sometimes, I'm not a theologian, but they are striking reflections on what the church can become and how people can enter faith. They're also very human considerations of what a state might be responsible for in the modern world, much more interested in things like social justice and the caritas component of Catholic social thought than his public perception. And unfortunately, the Pope, while he was writing many of these sort of important and very remarkable things, was allowing maybe what Tom mentioned is the mess that he was inherited to continue, not only the Roman Curia itself, sort of the bureaucracy running itself, but also sort of the elephant in the room, which was the growing Catholic sex scandal. And rather than sort of grab that bull by the horns, I think he sort of let it play out. He didn't really take it on in a way that a lot of people, both Catholic and not, thought was serious enough. And so that, for now, I think, will continue to overshadow a lot of the legacy that might come out of his writings.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about the selection of the next pope and the role of the papacy in the Catholic Church and the world, with Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter and Catholic Studies Professor Kevin Schultz of the University of Illinois at Chicago. We welcome your questions and comments for our guests at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And I'm going to dive in, or wallow, as the case may be, into some of the mess, as you put it, that the Pope Benedict had inherited and will be passing on to his successor. And just try to ask you both, what does this mean in the larger picture? And what's it going to be something on the minds of the cardinals as they choose the next one. But the list I have, the resignation, the 1 month early retirement at the Pope's request of British Cardinal Keith O'Brien after allegations of inappropriate acts committed against fellow priests during the 80s. The reports from Italian newspapers, I think La Repubblica was one of them, alleging a link between the Pope's resignation and the alleged discovery reported in a dossier of a network of gay prelates who were vulnerable to blackmail, things like that. And of course, some of the other ongoing scandals concerning child sex abuse by priests and to what degree that the church covered it up rather than dealing with it directly. Well, that's a very long question, but I'm just wondering, where does all this stand in what the church is dealing with now and what the next pope is dealing with? And why don't I throw it over to you, Professor Schultz, first?
Well, my thought is, and I specialize in American Catholicism, so I can speak more readily about the Catholics in the United States than the worldwide institution of the papacy. But my sense is, at least coming from the reports I read and the people I talk to and the students I teach, the church is really, there are, as it's sort of common to say, two churches in America right now. One that is pretty traditional and consistent with the teachings of the papacy, and then the other, which is very spiritual and continues to consider themselves Catholic and loves the story and the beauty and the transcendence of the Mass, and yet they are increasingly reluctant to say that they uphold the teachings of the Vatican and even the bishops and the priests in high regard. And the reason, of course, is, well, there are multiple reasons, but one of the biggest reasons, and especially for young Catholics today, is the failure of the Church to take responsibility for the Catholic sex abuse scandal and for the continued cover-up that that is going on. A lot of the Catholics that I've talked to, a lot of the reports that I read, say this is just unforgivable, and rather than getting better, slowly and surely the tales of cover-up are continuing to emerge. And I think this is causing more and more American Catholics to become increasingly disaffected with not necessarily Catholicism, but with the institution of the Church. And so for my mind, the interest in this, the transformation of the Pope, in some ways, it's a moment of hope where there might be a new Pope who comes in who wants to take more pastoral care of the flock rather than be a theologian as great as Benedict might have been. In that regard, he definitely wasn't a pastoral kind of pontiff. So there is, for many of the Catholics that I talk to and study, there is hope that this will happen, although they also sense that it might just be hope, because it's important to remember that all the cardinals who will be voting on the new pope were appointed by either Benedict or Pope John Paul II.
Tom Roberts, could you add to that?
Yeah, well, that's a superb analysis. I would agree with every element of it. I think that the reality, too, inside that conclave, they're going to know that Cardinal Brady of Scotland is not there because of accusations. They're also going to know that Cardinal Regali retired of Philadelphia, Carl Mahoney, retired of Los Angeles, two who represent a huge, I think, breach of trust with the Catholic faithful in two really important sees in the United States, are reminders of how deep this problem goes. And they also know, as Professor Schultz pointed out, this thing is going to keep rolling out. I mean, they're issuing their own warning, some of them, that this is not the last we're going to hear of it. There's going to be, Africa and Asia, Latin America. And the question, I think, for them, and I don't know if they're going to confront this or not, is what do we do about this? In Benedict's term, and I have to give him some real credit where it's due, he stepped into the mess with the Legion, an order, a very conservative order that was led by a guy named Father Maciel, who was its founder, who turned out to be living a double life, terribly corrupt, abused seminarians, had children by two different women on two different continents, and that was all found out eventually. But John Paul ignored that for 25 years, and in fact, he really, really supported Maciel and his cause, and just ignored the accusations of victims. When Benedict, just before he became Pope, reopened an investigation, he also did his work with the United States. He sat with a Monsignor at the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, which was looking at all this material, and read through the briefs from the United States, and the both of them became converted to the cause. They began to realize that it wasn't, an anti-Catholic media event in the United States, that there was some really deep problems. So I give him credit there. What is missing all the time, and as Pope, just to follow the Maciel line, very soon after he became Pope, he disciplined Maciel and then essentially took over the order, which I think is in terrible disarray at this point. But I think the point is, in all of that, what's missing is accountability at the highest levels and accountability by the people who oversaw the hiding and the shifting of priests. They hid this sin and crime for decades. And that's what's different about this sex abuse within the Church. And I think that hangs over the whole mess. It still is, and I don't know if they're going to address it in the conclave. I don't know if they're going to look for someone who really will take this on, will demand accountability at levels of the Church where the most damage is being done. But they're going to be sitting with people who have caused some of the greatest damage in the Church, I think, in the modern era.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and today is the day that Pope Benedict XVI is scheduled to resign from the Catholic papacy. And we're talking about the selection of his successor and related topics with Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter and Catholic Studies professor Kevin Schultz of the University of Illinois at Chicago. To join our conversation, call 333-9455. or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or go to our Facebook and Twitter pages at Focus 580. And I guess what you're talking about there, Tom, is the phrase I've heard is internal governance and of the church and how that needs to be attended to.
Well, I think there's, it's more than attended to. I think that there are two levels to it. One is just the structure of government, and the other is, what is the call to holiness when you reach, the purple robes of a bishop or the red robes of a cardinal? And you can't hold the rest of the church to standards of behavior and trust and truth, and just sort of ignore them when this huge problem arises. Just a quick story. I was in Rome during the last interregnum when in a 3-week period, John Paul died, Charles was married in England, Prince Rainier of Monaco died, and Benedict was elected. And it was interesting because the international cameras were going from, churches to palaces all over Europe. The only monarchy that still believes it works in that triptych was Rome. It was the Vatican. The other, the remnants of royalty were there, but no one took them terribly seriously as working governments. And so I think that, that in the 21st century, in this information age, that old palace doesn't hold the secrets anymore. That old structure doesn't hold them anymore. And I think that's partly what they're dealing with. How do we do this now in a world that's far different from what our robes and ceremonies around these kinds of things suggest?
We have a caller on the line. Doug from Spring Bay has a comment. Good morning, Doug. You're on the air.
Good morning. Well, the question for me is, how many of the cardinals in the conclave have skeletons in the closet? And by asking that question, it opens up the next question of, are they capable of reforming themselves? It seems to me that the church really needs deep and powerful reforms, taking away the idea of celibacy, opening up for married priests, allowing nuns to have more say in the proceedings of the church, conducting mass and so forth. But I guess I wonder if the church has the capacity to reform itself. And so I will get off and continue to listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. And that is a question. My understanding is that the College of Cardinals is made up of appointees of Pope Benedict and the late Pope John Paul II. There are certainly, if you're bringing up issues like marriage of priests, etc., they're certainly likely to be thinking along the lines of Pope Benedict. But if reform is something that's needed within, how willing is the College of Cardinals to look for change?
Obviously, it's we don't know the answer. We can look at the numbers, saying that every single one of them was appointed by the last two popes, and so it perhaps might be unlikely that changes will come beyond what the last two popes were favoring. But it's also worth remembering that when Angelo Roncalli, who became John the 23rd, was elevated, he was elevated to be a caretaker pope, and shortly after he became Pontiff, he decided to call what we now know as Vatican II. So the Spirit can move in interesting and unexpected ways. So it's worth keeping that in mind. But that said, just looking at the records of the people who are under consideration, looking at the people who will be voting on the matter, it seems relatively unlikely. That would sort of be my assessment. One thing that we might think about a little bit more seriously, rather than these dramatic structural changes like ending the celibacy or inviting women in, would be the new pope who comes in is much more of a pastoral kind of pontiff, one could imagine certain symbolic gestures that would be made, an open letter read at mass from the pope apologizing for the sins of the institution, or, in the past, if we look through history, there were instances where every priest was ordered to flog himself out in front of the church on Sunday morning as a way of saying, I'm sorry. So there are certain potential symbols symbolic gestures that might be made that would be a gesture of transformation, of recognizing some of the inherent problems without having the structural transformation.
Tom, do you have anything to add?
Yeah,
to that?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I don't think we're going to, you know, see a pope, any of the possibilities elected in that college, come out and say day two that, you know, we're going to consider women priests or ending celibacy or that sort of thing. I think what we might look for is exactly what Professor Schultz was talking about: a change in emphasis, a pastoral type, someone who is willing to sort of embrace the flock, if you will, rather than preach at it or attempt to just teach all the time. One of the cardinals made the comment, and he's going to be in the conclave. You know, many people today have come to doubt that there is still holiness or honesty in the church and the clergy. We must prove them wrong. We can be a true community of saints who shine as models of chastity and charity before a culture in great need of this witness. Well, that's, you know, they're nice words. But there's an admission there that I think, you know, Catholics who were around, you know, 40 or 50 years ago would find striking, that you know, there's an admission that people don't think we're all we think we say we are or are supposed to be. I don't know how much that permeates, but I would imagine going into this conclave, it's going to be very, very different from any other in the modern era because of this, you know, the weight of the scandals and the skepticism people have about, you know, this is church work, and I think one of the real problems is trying to find some authenticity in all of this. You know, who are we authentically as leaders? Is it just the office will confer on us certain powers and we're going to keep going, or do we, you know, do we look at deeper things? How are we going to be pastors in a changing world?
You are listening to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. My guests are Editor-at-Large Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter and Professor Kevin Schultz of the University of Illinois at Chicago. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and I welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And the phone numbers again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. We're talking about the selection of the next pope with Professor Kevin Schultz of the University of Illinois Chicago and Editor-at-Large Tom Roberts of the National Catholic Reporter. And I'm wondering about the church, the selection coming up with this College of Cardinals. I've read the Cardinals mostly come from Europe more than anywhere else, but at the same time, the church has actually been in decline, the Catholic Church in Europe. It's very strong in Latin America, but really growing in Africa and Asia. And what does that mean in the selection process and the challenges that the next pope will be facing? We may be talking about some things here, but other parts, Catholics and other parts of the world may have other concerns.
I think that's absolutely correct. It brings to mind, we were talking a little earlier about the legacy of Pope Benedict, and I think one of the things, maybe it'll turn out to be a failed legacy, one of the things he came in wanting to do in 2006-2007 was create basically a leaner and meaner Catholicism, especially in Europe. I don't think he necessarily wanted to grow the church tremendously in Europe, but he wanted to bring people back and have ardent supporters. In some ways, that big kerfuffle he got in when he was talking about Islam, the way he explained it was that he had deep reverence for the devotion and the faith that Muslims in Europe especially were demonstrating. Now, whether or not he succeeded in that, I mean, the numbers are against him. If you look at the data, the church hasn't necessarily been growing, at least of any significant rate, in Europe, and it continues to be a relatively secular place compared especially to the United States. It is an interesting question as to how what that will bring to the table when the cardinals sit down to vote, if they will take into consideration the fact that maybe they do want to grow the church in Africa and they'll pick somebody in Africa, or the largest Catholic country in the world is of course Brazil, and there are several good candidates from Brazil. So it's unclear as to how that will influence their decision. But I think it's important to remember also that you are right. A large number of the cardinals that have been recently elevated do have come from Europe.
Well, I have I've seen more than one list of possible candidates for Pope. I have one in front of me from Wikipedia. Are these lists useful at all, or are they just a wool gathering until the Cardinals actually do something?
You mean when you're dialing up your Irish bookie? I don't know. I mean, I lean heavily here on the reporting and the instincts of my colleague and friend John Allen, who's been covering the Vatican for us for a long time. And the list is heavy with Italians, and there are some others represented. And again, you know, you always have to be ready for the surprise. But I think that the reality that you spoke to in your question earlier about people may have concerns in other parts of the world that are not our concerns and not our battles, I think is very, very real. Because if you go, you know, to Brazil or you in areas of Africa, those bishops will be talking a whole lot more about many of what we would generally put under the umbrella social justice issues, inequity between, you know, the wealth and distribution of goods and that sort of thing between different parts of the world or among different parts of the world, as well as within their own societies. They see, you know, poverty and all that sort of thing in a far different way. And yet on social issues, homosexuality, gay marriage, that kind of thing, they are very, very, very conservative. But you know, they don't line up neatly along the political spectrum, but I think they'll bring that, certainly, all those interests into this conclave, because there are very different views of what a papacy would need to do or should be doing, I think, from those different parts of the world.
And you brought up homosexuality as regards to the Catholic Church. I believe that's a question. That's something that Marlene in Urbana had a question about. Marlene, good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting conversation. I think, even though I think it's totally wrong, I think one of the biggest problems that they must face, and perhaps the Pope has realized this and realized he's not a person that wants to face this or is qualified to face it, is the celibacy issue. Because the great amount of homosexuality being evidenced in the church, you know, brings up that whole issue of how do we solve that? How do we get new priests? How do we keep this alive and keep it healthy and admirable? And so the problem, though, that I see is if they do address celibacy and allow priests to marry, then they have to also get into the issue of homosexuality marriage. And that is a real big, big bugaboo for them. So I'm just curious as to you think if they will attack that.
Is that a question that's even going to come up for the next pope, or is that in the larger scheme of church politics not an issue that they're going to go to? Professor Schultz?
I would be very surprised if it came up. And how does it go? I wouldn't be surprised to be surprised in some ways. I don't think it's on any of the people who might be under consideration right now. It's not one of their priorities about ending celibacy. I think they can pretty fairly easily, if they wanted to, disconnect ending celibacy and then advocating for gay marriage. I think you could they could handle that one pretty easily by the standard line of marriage being only between a man and a woman. But it is interesting thinking of it from the American perspective, where more than half of the Catholics in the United States support same-sex marriage, and they overwhelmingly, like 80% and higher than 80% of Catholics support the use of contraception, things like that. And so it is an interesting contradiction between the sort of old-line church. So I could see more movement, perhaps, on things like contraception rather than ending celibacy. But again, I'm always open to being surprised.
And then there's the reality that that we do have married priests. Now, they are exceptions to the rule and usually come from the Episcopal Church, some Lutherans, a few Presbyterians, but you know, the question has to be asked, is that sort of the, you know, the wedge approach? We'll find out if this works and then maybe expand that a bit. But there's another element to this whole question of the number of priests, and I think it's been fascinating to me, because when I was doing that book, I got into some research and was talking a lot to demographers. And what they'll tell you is, until the mid-1940s, in the United States, this is the U.S. experience, until the 1940s, there really weren't that many priests. Then there was this huge escalation for a number of reasons, and it plateaued, and then there was a steep drop in the mid-60s after Vatican II and all kinds of things happening here. So the farther you get from it, the more that bump looks like a mesa. But during that period, too, we had this huge buildup of institutions and that sort of thing. But the demographers will say, don't look at that as normative and don't think we're going to get back to that because it was an aberration. It was never that way before. It's not going to be that way again. So the question becomes, how do you become a church? I mean, what is the church in 10 years? How do you change how you pastor? What's a parish? All those kinds of things. And we're seeing it play out a bit on the ground with, you know, parish closings and mergers and all the rest of it. There was a stunning quote in a book, a book-length interview with Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, in which he said he's begun to realize that one of the big problems for the American hierarchy is that they are being strangled by the behemoth of institutional Catholicism that they inherited. I found that a stunning quote from the Archbishop Cardinal of New York in a position that was, you know, historically defined by those big institutions. And if they're being strangled by it, the question is, how do you get out of that? And I think that that's sort of the lively question I see for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. What is this model of Catholicism, this big institutional Catholicism of the Northeast and the Upper Midwest? How does that change? How do we move away from that to something, I guess, more sustainable?
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and there's still time for your questions or comments about the Pope and the selection of the next Pope for National Catholic reporter, editor-at-large Tom Roberts, and U of I Chicago Catholic Studies Professor Kevin Schultz at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And question I was having, moving on to the selection process, and, of course, something that we don't really get to see, but there's going to be a conclave of cardinals meeting sometime in March on this. And we know what happens on the outside as we wait for certain colors of smoke to come out of that little chimney. But do we have any idea what's going on inside with the deliberations? How does it work? Is there politicking and horse trading going on? What level does it work at? And Tom, maybe as
well, we know that there's horse trading going on. We know that there's politicking going on. We know that there are, you know, discussions among cardinals, never publicly. And of course, if you mention that you're at all interested in it, you're out. That reflects badly on you. So I mean, all this stuff happens in private. There are certainly cardinals calling each other, cardinals calling theologians and their advisors, and all the rest of it. But I think that once they get inside the conclave, it's pretty much sealed off. I mean, they've put in a false floor in the Sistine Chapel so that they can't even tweet out or, you know, do any kind of communicating, and that becomes a pretty private and process that is absolutely secret. Now there will be leaks afterwards, of course, people explaining what went on and various ways getting some of that news out. But it's a very secret process in a very secret culture.
Professor Schultz, do we know anything about past conclaves as to how work gets done?
Well, I was just thinking back to the last conclave, and Tom is exactly right. We know very little about what happened, and I remember watching the news, and there was just nothing. People were still speculating even while the cardinals were meeting, and then, you know, the smoke appears, and then all of a sudden the Pope is announced, and we're not really sure how that happened. So I do think the levels of secrecy and within the conclave are pretty solid. We do have some insight after the fact on what goes on, horse trading, cardinals getting together, talking about things like geography, talking about things like intellect. That has happened, and you almost can see that as kind of a human sort of part of human nature, where all of a sudden you think, okay, we have to pick somebody who's going to be our leader. Let's talk about this and figure it out. But for the most part, when they're in conclave, you don't hear about any of this.
I'm wondering, I understand that the conclave date is being moved up in the hopes that they'll have a pope to celebrate, Mass at Easter. Is that a pressure in itself? If there is a stalemate at this conclave, could you see the pressure going on the cardinals to get to choose someone just for that theatrical moment of having a clear leader at the helm of the church on Easter Sunday?
I would be surprised. The church certainly has a talent for theatrics and has for many thousands of years. But whether or not that would dictate the selection of a pope, I would find that to be very surprising. So I can't see that being any inherent pressure to force them into a decision that they didn't feel was right or they didn't feel they were ready to make. But it sure would look nice, huh?
Let me take the question, and this is really one of the big questions for lots of people who are not Catholics. And that is, we certainly pay a lot of attention to it, but what does it mean for the rest of the world who the Pope is, and how does that make a difference? What sort of man is selected to be the next pontiff if you're simply another Christian, or if you're of another faith entirely, or just simply wherever you are around the world? What difference does it make?
Well, I think, you know, let's start with numbers. It's a big organization. And, you know, a huge global organization. I think Rome arguably is one of the best listening posts in the world. So there's that thing. It's the big kid on the block. But the other part is, I think that, you know, with all the problems, and this, the paper I work for has documented them at great length, there's a bit of an anchor, something to look at, some hope at a person who, an institution that speaks some truth to cultures and across cultural lines. And I'm thinking, Professor Schultz said that, you know, the sort of Caritas element of Catholic teaching was big in Benedict's writings, and it really got kind of short shrift. And I think that's true. When you think back, let's say, just in terms of the United States, that was a voice really opposing our intervention, for instance, in Iraq. His Peace Day message in January, he led off with this lament over, you know, international violence and what he called unrestrained capitalism as a cause of this kinds of divisions. Well, that's provocative stuff. And, you know, he's got a bully pulpit. When you're saying that kind of stuff, it may not always make the evening news, but for Catholics and those in religious circles and those listening to these kind of things, it's stuff to make you stop and think and question about what you're doing and how your culture is acting.
I guess the challenge is, are statements like that covered up by all the attention paid to the scandals in the church?
I would say, to a large degree, yes. But it is worth remembering that these statements were made. And I think Tom is exactly right. But to get directly to your question, Jim, about what does it matter who the Pope is, I think the right answer is it depends who gets elected. If you get another Pope who sort of is a good theologian maybe, but doesn't have the pastoral capacities that maybe we were lacking in Benedict, but definitely had in John Paul II, I can imagine that most of the world wouldn't necessarily care. The 1.1 billion Catholics out there might care, or again, they might not. But if you get a Pope who is much more transformative, who is much more eager to maybe not only hear the parishioners, but take actions, both symbolic and bureaucratic, to right wrongs, or to go beyond words and to call on Catholics to write to their legislators and their governors and tell them to protest war when it comes up. So you could imagine a pope that would come in and take the Caritas, the charity, the caring mission of the Catholic Church, which is profound and which you see on the ground all the time in Catholic charities, in the work that many of the nuns and many of the priests do. You see it very vibrant and active in American life. And if a pope were willing to grab onto that and prioritize that, one could imagine that this bully pulpit would become even more important and more profound throughout the world and not just to the Catholics. One difficult part about that is that the things that American Catholics think are important and would like to see from a pope are maybe different than what the Brazilian Catholics want and what the Mexican Catholics want and what the Italian Catholics want. And so it's worth remembering that the pope has to sort of serve all of these populations and all of these demands. But I could see a pope coming in and really opening up the Caritas mission, the caring and charity mission, and making and prioritizing that, and perhaps becoming really transformative and really influential throughout the world and beyond just the 1.1 billion Catholics.
I've been checking up online. I have the BBC's webpage in front of me, and they're doing a lot of coverage of the final day of Pope Benedict in office. They note that the pope was flown by helicopter to his summer residence at Castel Gandolfo near Rome. If I'm adjusting for time right, his papacy should end officially at 1 p.m. Central Time, and then 115 cardinals will meet in Rome on Monday to plan the election of the next pope, and that's just planning the conclave. That's not the conclave itself. My final question for both of you is, for other Christian churches, for Protestant churches around the world, for the Orthodox Church, what do you think the leaders of those churches are thinking and wondering, and what would they like to see in the next pope? Tom, if I could go to you first.
Well, I think that they might want a warmer embrace and a sort of a revival of the ecumenical spirit that existed, you know, prior to Vatican II, and that existed with John Paul II and his invitations to, you know, not only other denominations in the Christian world, but other faiths as well. Although I must say that Pope Benedict and the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, I think, as I've read it, very good friends and spend a lot of time together, even though, I guess, theologically they disagreed on a lot of elements. But I think that other denominations and other faiths, I guess, would want a warmer welcome at the Vatican and perhaps more engagement on a regular basis.
Professor Schultz?
Yeah, I would agree. And just speaking about work on the ground in the United States, when, say, after Vatican II, the Catholic Church was more receptive to working in sort of causes on the ground, in dealing with issues like hunger or major social issues, Protestants and Jews throughout the United States have often been eager to work with Catholics when Catholics have been willing to do so. Always a little suspicious, but nevertheless, the record is pretty good. So, and I don't think necessarily Benedict has sort of overturned that. And in fact, after his comments in 2006 about Islam being spread by the sword, he did backtrack and he did sort of extend his hand to Muslims. He went to Mecca. And to Jews, he changed some of the language in the Catholic Mass so that it was less negative about Jews. So I think that there were some overtures made there. And I think, again, on a more sort of grassroots level, those kinds of overtures would be welcome.
Kevin Schultz, Assistant Professor of History and Catholic Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His publications include Tri-Faith America, How Postwar Catholics and Jews Held America to Its Protestant Promise, now out in paperback from Oxford University Press. And we've also been talking with Tom Roberts, editor-at-large for the National Catholic Reporter and author of the book The Emerging Catholic Church, A Community's Search for Itself, published by Orbis Books. We've been talking about the next pope during the waning hours of Pope Benedict. Thank you both for being with me on Focus.
Pleasure. Pleasure to be with you.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Tomorrow on Focus, taxes. The alternative minimum tax was patched in January. I have no idea what that means, but it's important to a lot of us as we prepare our 2012 income tax return. So on Friday's show, we'll have two tax experts in the studio from McGladley LLP. And if John Breen can't answer your questions, I'm sure Marty Verdick can. We hope you'll join us. Today's program was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director and handles your calls. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WYLL.